Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron discuss the value of a college education. Why is there a correlation between household income and education? If you already have enough money saved up for college, is the piece of paper worth more than the dollars spent? And what about the knowledge gained, or the intangible networking effects, or the additional benefits of self-improvement? Aaron admits he may not have been mature enough to forgo college, but Trishul thinks he likely learned more from his practical work experience. Household education and incomes may both be effects of the growing income inequality in society. So how then can we get households to emphasize the future when too many need to worry about today? And now on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti, I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you as well. Last week, we were trying to talk about universal basic income, this idea that it's worth exploring the idea that providing a basic income, something like $1,000 a month to a population, could help alleviate a lot of the concerns and a lot of the problems that come up. And it was an interesting conversation, but we found that it was kind of fascinating. After we recorded our conversation, we talked for another 30 or 40 minutes around a lot of the things that lead to income inequality, value of education, the tax system a little bit, and just kind of playing around ideas. We want to go even deeper now. We found that conversation fascinating. And the main premise, Trishul asked me this question. He had been saving up, and he's saving for his young daughter, and he's trying to save enough to spend to cover 4 years at a private college and 4 years of grad school, whether that's some kind of professional school like law school or medical school or pursuing a master's or PhD. He's going to let his daughter decide, but he wanted to save up enough to give that education opportunity. And that's a very ambitious goal. Trishul is doing a great job saving. And he's trying to save up about $1 million to fund that. The question is not, is that too ambitious or should be saving that? But let's say he's successful and he has saved up $1 million for his daughter to go to college. What if he turned that $1 million into his daughter's own personal UBI? What if he used a 3% withdrawal rate and research shows that that's a low enough withdrawal rate that even adjusted for inflation could probably last her entire life. You get time frames on the scale of 60 or 70 years. It's not the 4% withdrawal rate that lasts for 30 years. 3% is pretty close to sustainable through any historical market cycle. So what if he took that $1 million he had saved for college and gave her $30,000 per year for the rest of her life? Which would be better? And we actually kind of talked about what would we do? Could we think of what we did when we were 17 or 18 and how we would make that decision? And even in retrospect, would we have done the same thing or changed our mind? So Trishul, for you, do you remember what you said? When you were 17, if your parents gave you that option, $1 million, be $30,000 per year for the rest of your life, or will fully fund education. You now have that choice. What would you have done when you were 17, 18? And trying to keep in mind how a teenager will be trying to make these big life decisions.
That's a good question, Aaron. When that question was first posed and we turned that back around to ourselves, what went through my mind is I kind of went through some inner struggle between the two scenarios and opportunity costs associated with each. For example, going down the traditional route of pursuing an education and then a higher education and then starting one's career, what that would mean versus somebody who tries to start their career immediately upon graduation of high school is you're delaying a starting point of earning income by about a decade. And what that hopefully means for the person who does delay that career for a decade is that once they start their career, of course, they start at a higher amount and then hopefully earn more over their lifetime to compensate for that cost of education. Mm-hmm. Now, on the flip side, if I were to immediately join the workforce, then I would be earning money over 10 years. And after 10 years, I would have 10 years of experience, which might go a long way, meaning I might be earning the same amount as somebody who just recently graduated from a professional school after 10 years. So I guess that's why this is not an easy question to answer. But one thing I might want to point out is around the time I was in high school, graduating to go to college, was around the time that the internet was taking off and technology was well on fire. This was the late 90s. And it was maybe the perfect time for an individual to actually be able to get a job without a diploma in a high performance career as a software engineer, where this is one of the few cases where you can be self-taught and you can learn on the fly how to become a computer programmer, and firms will hire you if you have those skills without a degree. So it might very well be possible that this quasi alternative to a standard education might make sense for an individual like myself at that time.
I agree with the math. I agree with all the numbers there. And it might be a bigger question of psychology of a 17 or 18 year old. I thought long and hard about what is the value of college? And some of the ideas that I encourage other people to think about, is it the bachelor's degree itself? When looking through a job pool, employers can use just the fact that you have a bachelor's degree as a screening tool to separate those who have shown the initiative and internal drive to push themselves to further their own education, and they've shown that self-improvement. Those skills correlate with being a good employee. So is that just having the bachelor's degree is as a screening tool? There's one study I like that looked at trying to quantify the value of a degree at Harvard. And they saw that people who went to Harvard, no surprise, tended to have higher household incomes and higher lifetime incomes. What was interesting is that people who applied to Harvard actually had similar results as people who actually went. So people who applied to Harvard but didn't go had similar results as those who actually did get a bachelor's degree from Harvard. And they said no more study was needed, but one of their guesses was that if a high school student is confident enough in their abilities and sees their future self well enough that they think they can get into Harvard, they already have the internal prerequisites to be successful in life. That it's the idea that they're confident that they could do well at Harvard, that that's why they're applying, is the same skills that lead them to those higher incomes, whether or not they go to Harvard at all. And a lot of them end up going to other high-level colleges anyways, so it's really hard to separate the value of a Harvard degree from Yale or Cornell or UCLA. That's a little harder, but if you are a teenager and you're confident in your abilities that you're applying to Harvard, that is a good sign for lifetime success in terms of household income, especially. Maybe it's other things like, could it be the networking effects? Could it be just if you are associating with other people and building up strong friendships with other people who went to a successful college, does that make it easier to get jobs, kind of make connections, get new deals done, not necessarily in terms of just sales, but I know this other person who's a manager at this other company who's hiring for this position you'd be great for, and I'll introduce you. Are there enough of those networking effects? Is the value of college in the actual knowledge that you gain? So this is what you're talking about, where you can learn to be a computer programmer without going to college and getting a computer science degree. that education itself now exists. Maybe it didn't 20 years ago, but is pretty close. So is the value of college the actual knowledge and practical skills you gain, or could you also gain those exact same skills outside of college without having to pay tens of thousands of dollars per year? And one of the ideas I got while I was actually in college, my senior year, was the idea that undergrad taught people how to learn. And this is a little more amorphous concept, but is the idea that so much of college is independent, self-sufficient. The professors have a lecture, there's TAs will help you if you show up, but no one's taking attendance. They'll grade you and tell you how done. You have to figure out, how do I absorb that material? How do I learn it, internalize it, to be able to use that knowledge, create the analysis, and take that next step that is common with anything you're learning? And being able to do that yourself is an incredibly valuable life skill that applies many, many years after college. Anytime you're studying for anything, you have to be able to take the material, figure out the best way for you to learn. There are different types of learning styles. Internalize it to be able to actually have a practical, fundamental knowledge to use in the future. So these were some of the things that I thought about when we talked about, would I, given that choice, go to college? I would do it again. I enjoyed it enough, but it was enough of those little things. My best friends today were all other people who worked for intramural sports at UCLA. I feel much more confident in my ability to learn new material independently on my own. I learned so much more for work and my profession after college. Even though I have math and philosophy degrees, I don't know that the material I learned was directly applicable. There's one class on actuarial mathematics, how life insurance companies and mortgage companies determine premiums and rates. But I don't know how much of the value of college was just the knowledge or even the bachelor's degree. I think it was those other things that benefited me personally in retrospect. And I don't know if my 17-year-old self would have been comfortable and ready to enter the workforce and try to build up my skills through work and expanding my knowledge personally. I don't know if I would have gained the network that I have, or if I would enjoy my life as much. I don't know that I would have ever felt comfortable to start a business. And I think that's some of the theories of UBI, where even if I had that choice, I still think I would have gone to college. I think there were enough other things than just the costs and the income that really benefited me. So I don't think you quite answered the question. If you were to go back, Tricia, would you go to college, or would you like to do something else, enter the workforce, build up your education yourself, or even start your own business?
I think those other options would have taken a lot higher consideration from my perspective. And the reason I say that is I felt like for myself, even though I was a good student or pretty okay, I felt like I did a lot more of my learning and excelling when I actually was working. I felt like that type of environment for learning was a lot more productive for me. It allowed me to think more critically and more abstractly and come up with creative solutions and be able to use them. Whereas I felt like the way that education was structured from high school into college, although it became a lot more vigorous in parts of my educational training at university, I felt like the practical experience I learned at an actual job were, for me, a lot more rewarding. And I think that's why it might actually come down to individual personality and in the way that people learn. We all know everybody learns differently. So I think with the second option, where somebody gets that $30,000 as opposed to the prepaid college, I think it opens up the door to that individual figuring out what is best for themselves, meaning maybe they do end up spending that $30,000 on college. But they do it on their own terms. Maybe since there is a cost factor, they're pretty efficient on how they allocate that money instead of just going to a school, kind of like for the sake of going to school. We've heard these situations where people automatically jump into the college boat, not really even sure what they want to do with the degree, and then end up with picking a major and end up picking a line of courses where now that they have a piece of paper, it's not really something that the market values. But they do have another piece of paper saying they owe $100,000 in tuition. So I think maybe that's why that option B might provide some value. For example, even if that education provided at a college was important and valuable to learn, we've already said a couple of times that you can take any course offered at these top institutions for free online because a lot of them have opened them up. And that's something, again, that wasn't an option 20 years ago, but it is an option today. So if you want to learn everything that a MIT student learns or a Stanford student learns at their 4 years at university, you can do that for free. Now, you won't get that paper, as we've mentioned, but hopefully that extra $200,000 or $400,000 in your back pocket will make up for that piece of paper in some way. And the other thing that we've mentioned is the networking ability. You know, coming from a strong alma mater provides a strong network that you can rely upon. And I also say that's a pretty heavy price to pay. You know, we're talking about $400,000 in future dollars for that type of networking ability. So I'm hoping society can come up with a better alternative than relying on that. Would be my kind of hopeful counter to that particular argument. The other thing I might put forward is I think there are a segment of careers that don't really need a college education, but are still great careers, like trades, for example. You know, I know every time I call a plumber, $80 to $100, you know, an hour. Something like that might be not a bad choice because it's something where even though technology is advancing, you're still going to need to use the bathroom or you're still going to need lights and an electrician and all these various trades. So I think that it might open up the doors to allowing those types of options get a little bit higher consideration under people's mindset.
My father-in-law was a metal fabricator in San Francisco for a long time and produced mostly elevator parts. And so it was very, very close to the entire elevator industry. Knew everyone who ever built or repaired an elevator in San Francisco. And he's retired now, but one of the things he was telling me the other day is that in our current situation, certain buildings have to have elevators repair like on staff on site in case of emergencies. So mostly hospitals, they will have elevator repair on site 24 hours a day. And so there's maybe three or four to five guys who are kind of rotating these shifts. And the elevator repair companies that hire them are billing at $400 per hour. Now, a decent chunk of that goes to the company to also recover costs, cover some of the tools and training aspects. But the individual elevator repair person is probably getting a decent chunk of that. So it does remind me that, yeah, sometimes the trades and going through an apprenticeship, the incomes and the needs are there. So I really do understand what you're saying about that idea that the professional degree or professional job isn't the only thing that can be a high paying job. But I do wonder, we have seen historically that households with a college degree make more money than households without, kind of on average. And first, I'm going to assume that that path continues, that that trend continues. So first, do you agree that that trend is likely to continue, that households with a college degree will on average make more money than households without a college degree?
I think so, because that natively includes people who at a graduation level of high school likely have a lower level of skill, because of course the people that don't go to college includes a subset of the segment that didn't graduate high school either. So but maybe a better apples to apples comparison might be household incomes, like you had mentioned earlier, for individuals who, for example, got into Harvard but didn't go, versus individuals who got into Harvard but didn't go to any other college, versus people who got into Harvard and went to Harvard. So maybe something like that might be a good apples to apples to apples comparison.
Okay, that does, I think, answers my follow-up question would be kind of, why do you think that is? Why is it likely the case that households with a college degree, or in making apples to comparison, households where the person was qualified to get into a top college would have higher incomes and higher household incomes than those without a college degree?
Just to be specific, so individuals who got into a higher education program but decided not to go?
I guess because I think those would probably be comparable, but just what is it, what are the factors that lead to those higher household incomes among those who do go to college, if it's not the degree itself? But I'll grant the premise that we should be comparing people who got into college and went versus people who got into college and didn't go. And I do think that they'll have similar household incomes. But why are they successful? What are those skills that they have or have learned?
Right. So in order to even get into college and be accepted, you do have to pass some bar. For example, you have to have, for many of these top schools in particular, you have to have pretty good academics and pretty good social skills, interview, for example, and writing skills. And you have to go through all those hoops. So if you're not at that level, it's safe to say that your life performance is probably going to be hampered. So I'd say that it's quite understandable that there would be a difference between those two groups of individuals. But I think the key point, though, is if you do make the cut and you decide not to go, again, this is a good open question, you may be just okay. And that might be the main point of this all, meaning we should all strive to get in to a top school, but that doesn't necessarily mean that going makes the most sense.
Okay, so I think I'm trying to tie it back to our conversation last week about then what leads to some of these income inequalities and asset inequalities, because that answer tends to imply it's mostly skills and or aptitude, or like you said, getting over that bar of qualification, whatever that bar may be. But I think historically, we've seen that's not the only thing. There's other things that lead to income and net worth inequality. I'm curious, what do you think those might be?
Some things that we did touch upon at a high level in the last episode on UBI is that there is significant inequality, meaning over the last generation, individuals who were in the lower end of incomes end up now earning less than they used to. And individuals at the top end of the income distribution end up earning a lot more than they used to. And the more you earn, the more likely you will earn more, and the less you earn, the more likely that your incomes will go down over time based upon the trends that we've been seeing. And this has led to a pretty big polarization or pretty unequal distribution of wealth. And what we had mentioned in the last episode is that perhaps this relates to a few things. First off, it's the notion that there is a pretty big difference in how wealthy individuals are taxed and how corporations are taxed versus how individuals are taxed. Corporations are taxed based upon capital gains and dividends primarily, and these tax rates tend to be lower than individuals, where the individual tax rates tend to top out at a much higher percentage than the top end of capital gains and interest taxes or dividends taxes. So that's thing one, which we can dig into. And then thing two is there have been some studies that based upon where you begin has a pretty high correlation in terms of where you might end up in terms of what was your starting household income. There's been some studies that we may have come across, which is, for example, they did a study where somebody from a very low income household has to do pretty much everything right, get into a school and get into a university and get scholarships and whatnot. And if you compare that small group of individuals with somebody from a high income household who does everything wrong, meaning ends up dropping out and gets a drug problem and commits a crime and so on, and then maybe tries to earn an income, both of those two subsets of individuals end up about the same. So it kind of tells you that it's a lot harder if you're starting from a lower base to climb out, whereas it's a lot easier to maintain where you're at if you're starting from a higher base. And that's kind of what that data showed. Other pieces of data have pointed to the notion that, as we have seen with income changes over the last generation, also individuals' changes from, if you start in a low decile of income, the chances of climbing out are far lower, and the chances of staying in a higher decile of income are far higher, just statistically.
Okay, so I want to refute your first point on corporate taxes quickly, but dig into why where you start matters, because I think there's a lot of complexity there. When it comes to corporate taxes, especially over the last generation or two, one, we have seen that corporations are multinational, that they actually are trying to take advantage of the global economy to make more money and to help more people and sell to more people. And one of the factors of that is the U.S. kind of has to compete, in air quotes, with other tax jurisdictions. There's a reason the double Irish with a Dutch sandwich exists. So it's corporations in the U.S. taking advantage of Irish and Dutch tax laws. And so when we look at U.S. corporate tax law, we have to kind of keep that in mind, that part of the reason why we have lower taxes is to incentivize those companies to stay and grow here and employ U.S. citizens. And that we can explore kind of is that what we want to do as a society. But the other thing is that corporate taxes are double taxed, that the corporations pay taxes at the corporate level, and then every individual person who benefits from that corporation, the stockholders receive dividends or capital gains, the employees get paid salaries, those are also taxed at the individual level. So I tend to be a little more lenient on the corporate tax side because they're already, again, they're competing with, or the U.S. is competing with international companies, other tax jurisdictions, and it's already double taxed. So I'm okay with corporations having lower tax rates. And my argument, it's not necessarily a fact, is that the U.S. has thrived over the last few generations. There's a reason why we have the largest economy in the world, And even though we don't have the largest population, and I think that those factors are part of it. And I'm okay with that aspect. The resulting income inequality, I think, is a concern. And that idea of where you start mattering so much is something I wonder, is it even fixable? And there's things like I've talked to other friends, and I'll ask you the same question. Do you expect your daughter to go to college? And the reason I ask that question and phrasing is that my wife and I both went to UCLA, and from basically their birth, as soon as they're talking, they know there's this expectation that they're going to college. That it's not a, oh, after high school, if you go to college, it's after high school, you go to college. That's just what comes next. And that trickles down to all the little things that we discuss and talk about as they're growing of, here's why your academics matter. Here's why focusing on schoolwork matters. Here's why having other things outside of classwork matters. And like, we don't phrase it in terms of applying to college, but it's these little incremental things that we are pushing them to do. And I genuinely wonder, is that because my wife and I grew up in homes that could also support that we went to college, and now we make enough incomes that we can have the free time to focus on their education? And is that a positive compounding effect that other households that if they barely scrape by to get to college, they still have that mentality of hoping their child goes to college, but are they working a little few more hours, or they don't have as much free time, or have to devote other resources elsewhere in the household? And all the little parts that you talked about, that's the skills bar of like building up those social skills, building up their academic skills, is that also kind of the negative spiral in the other way? And so I'm curious if you have thoughts on why is it the case that where you start matters, and what are some of those little benefits? And so kind of, do you expect your daughter to go to college, or are you hoping your daughter goes to college? Or maybe it takes your 30,000 UBI for the rest of her life.
What I want to instill, hopefully, is the notion that self-improvement over a lifetime is important. And that drive to always better oneself is important. And whether it has that label of college or any other type of self-improvement, maybe is not as important. I think the key value is wanting to better oneself through knowledge. And that's what I hope to instill. And I think the way that may tie back to the data that we're seeing in terms of socioeconomic disparity continuing, I think maybe that relates to the notion we talked about before with healthcare and emergency rooms and low-income households when it comes to UBI, where if your income is so low, you're not really thinking about the future, you're worried about tomorrow. It's hard to think past the next day or the next year, let alone the next decade, to get all the ducks in a row to go to college if you're worried about your next meal. So I can see how that can be a pretty big drag. And also the notion of just familiarity, where we've also seen with some data that if you're in a household where a parent has actually gone through the steps of going to university and graduating, you're a lot more likely to graduate yourself if you go. Whereas if you're the first person to go on this venture, it's a lot more difficult just because it's something that hasn't really been traversed by the close people that you know and care about. So I think all of that perhaps relates. And as far as the income disparity itself, with the points that we brought up and you reflected upon in terms of the actual tax rates, for example, between corporations and individuals, I would say, yeah, the big pushback between the high level of corporate taxes that we've seen and their subsequent lowering has been the fact that, yes, the U.S. corporations do need to remain competitive on a global scale, thing one. Thing two is that, yes, corporations have led to a strong amount of growth in GDP and prosperity for generations. But unfortunately, thing three, what we've seen and noted is that wealth hasn't really been distributed in a manner that's been quite equitable. It's gone, as we've seen and discussed, to a small percentage, a small minority. The other thing is, yes, we do have the largest economy, but we are no longer the wealthiest earners per capita. In fact, that gets worse and worse and worse. And again, per capita income is just showing you how the average individual is doing in terms of their growth in incomes. And as we said, that's kind of the big issue. The average hasn't been growing so much, but the wealthy has been growing a lot more.
So I do like that idea that you're teaching your daughter self-improvement and wanting to better oneself. I can see that idea of trying to teach them to overcome challenges and trying to teach grit is the kind of thing that will lead to success in life through whatever path they pursue, but also tends to correlate, especially through childhood, with doing well in school and working hard through classes and reaching that bar to be able to apply for college. So I can see early on the skills could go either way, and maybe they have that decision later on down the road. I do think about the marshmallow test that we reference every now and then. There have been follow-up studies and concerns that it ends up being another socioeconomic test. The idea that if a child can trust that if they don't eat the marshmallow, they'll get to next time, whether it's 5 minutes later or whatever, there has to be a household that supports that and raising that child supports that idea that they know and they can trust that it will be there and promises will be fulfilled. But if they're in a household where there's 5 mouths and 4 marshmallows, if they don't eat the marshmallow, they don't get 1 marshmallow. And so they learned, like you mentioned, to focus on the present and take care of the issue at hand and the issue right in front of them. And learning and internalizing that delayed gratification does become a little more difficult. So I can see if we can focus on teaching to better oneself rather than just focus on the knowledge aspect, that might be one of those differences. And then back on the corporate tax side, I do wonder if the U.S. is going down the path we want as a society, whether it's fortunate or unfortunate. And is this kind of what majority of people keep wanting? That they're okay, whether it's they understand it consciously or not, with the idea of greater economy and larger corporations, even if their average income is going down, because that seems to keep playing out.
That's an interesting question. I think it's one of those things where over the last generation, it's been the first kind of generation where you're not entirely expected to be considerably better off than the previous. And I think it's one of those things that accelerates, kind of like what we've seen with COVID, where you see a small upward growth, but then all of a sudden you see an exponential growth that might appear tiny, almost unnoticeable. But as we know, exponential growth in things over time leads to chaos very quickly. And I think that's kind of what we're going to see if the similar trend continues for one more generation. And we've said this before with just the raw numbers of how housing prices, education prices, and healthcare prices continue to accelerate beyond average GDP growth. You know, whereas GDP grows around 2% per year, or CPI grows around 2% per year, we're seeing these specific household expenses grow at like 5, 6, 7% per year. Meaning, I don't think the average person is going to be too comfortable with all of their income going for just these three things, leaving zero for food. So it might be okay now, and it might have been okay for the last 10, 20 years, but I think there's a breaking point. There's some point where the number of beds in the ICU will be overwhelmed. There's a certain point where you can't keep having these small incremental changes each year lead to a point where it's sustainable for the long run. That's my concern. And I think in order to remain competitively, yeah, the corporate tax rate has to be competitive. But then we have to think as a society, okay, what are we going to do about the problem that something like that creates? And that's where these notions of, you know, UBI might make sense. It's that, well, if everybody has a UBI, then hopefully you'll never have a kid who doesn't get a marshmallow.
Maybe you're implying that it's not trying to get more people to college or kind of raise more people over that bar, but trying to raise the bottom a little bit?
Perhaps. I think, you know, the notion we've seen is that if the average American household is $500 away from disaster, then there's quite a lot at the bottom to require raising. But that's a lot of potential too. Imagine if this whole demographic of individuals, which might be very well the majority soon, if not the largest minority at this point, imagine if they were contributing at that level where they are able to focus on self-improvement rather than reactive survival.
That's interesting. So do you think that as a society, we could encourage individual households to think about delayed gratification, to think about the teaching children self-improvement through knowledge? Do you have any ideas or guesses how that kind of transition from the society level to the individual household level could take place?
I think so. I think the notion that there might be a large demographic of people in society that are kind of living paycheck to paycheck and have things so tied up in the short term that they can't think longer term, a UBI may free up a percentage of those people. And we've also mentioned before, again, that the marshmallow experiment, the follow-up studies have shown that there's a strong socioeconomic component, meaning the households that didn't have enough marshmallows were the ones with the children that couldn't wait for that extra 5 or 10 minutes for that second marshmallow. They ate the one that they had in front of them immediately. So I think not only would the UBI help provide some basis for households to be able to better overcome short-term trouble so that they can focus on the longer term, which I think is a positive synergy. But I also think, yes, a society can do a better job of teaching these things. My personal opinion is a lot of the educational system is a bit antiquated to begin with. There's a lot of skills that they teach in school that I think need a revamping. Like, you know, when was the last time you used SOHCAH TOEIC? Or how often do you plan on taking a derivative in your life? But the fact of the matter is you still, I think, need a good understanding of finance or how interest rates work or how compound growth works. No matter who you are, you're going to need a bank account. You're going to need to invest some money. So I think a stronger understanding of these newer core principles would also be sensible. I think you definitely need to have a strong understanding of statistics, for example. And it's something that's overlooked, but I think it's far more important than being able to do a lot of the standard courses that are taught today, being able to just understand how numbers and probabilities work. So I think there could be some actual changes in what we teach, but also I think UBI may help in how we are able to learn.
I would probably disagree with I could see adding some material, and I guess if we had to add something, just given finite hours, they would have to drop something. But I have really appreciated the idea that elementary and high school are teaching a broad variety of subjects to ensure that you get exposure to everything. And that high schools kind of have this idea that they don't know what you're going to pursue in college. And so they're going to expose you to everything. And this is actually one of the big differences between myself and my wife. My wife went to UCLA as an engineer. She went into the engineering school. And I maybe should have done that. Like, just knowing my personality and the other engineers that we've met along the way, an engineer path might have suited me pretty well. But my high school didn't have any computer programming at all, nothing at that level, and so I had no exposure. So I applied to College of Letters and Sciences to get a math degree, and I do wonder if I had been exposed to it earlier in high school, would I've gone down that path. That's one of my kind of big life what ifs. But I do agree that we need better statistics and probability. I think that just dropping off trigonometry doesn't make sense, but I don't know what I would drop, because I do think that history is important. I think that a lot of language arts and being able to develop a cogent argument, being able to write clearly for people to understand, I think those are all valuable skills for society. So I don't know what I would drop, but I do agree with improving statistics, basic financial literacy, those would help, but I don't know if that alone would be enough.
Well, it's hard to say offhand what we might drop, but you know, that's where data comes in. The reason I picked out trigonometry is I think I remember reading a very small percentage of employed people use trigonometry. And the same article made the case that a lot of people, or a large percentage of people, will still have to worry about their finances. So it's just one of those things where data can help guide us, and we can't just keep adding more, like you said. We can't just have everybody learn everything. So I think it's well worth it to just, again, let evidence and experimentation and research be our guide to understand that maybe there's a more efficient way to teach people what values most in an evolving society.
I think that's probably the biggest takeaway. I'd like to end on that idea, that I think as a society, we could really benefit from accepting experimentation at society level, which means that if you teach one high school one thing and another high school another thing, one of those will end up being better. And we don't know which one, but we have to accept that the students at the school that were taught the inferior thing don't necessarily lose out on life. Like it's one of those kind of cold economic ideas that I don't know if our society will ever actually accept. That the idea that even in retrospect, one group was taught something better than another group. and therefore one group was worse off. I don't know if our society would accept that, even though I wish that we could accept just the idea of experimentation at a societal level.
Yeah, I think that there's alternative ways to do it than forcing a randomized controlled trial on students, where some students will not get the privilege of having a certain benefit. For example, that you might just even compare a school district that is proactive enough to want to do this, make a change in the curriculum, versus one that just chooses not to, and then control for demographics. You know, things like that could be done. But I think the general theme is it's a good thing to have policy be driven by evidence.
Yeah. I agree with that. I think that is one of our country's big issues. Not even just currently, big picture in general. But I know it's not our usual high point, but I think that we probably want to wrap up there before we go talk for another hour.
I think that sounds good. We covered a good amount of ground, but these are definitely topics that probably need a good amount of consideration and thought. So I imagine over future episodes, we might circle back to some of these points here and there.
Sounds good. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Trishul. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks, Aaron. I enjoyed this conversation as well, and I look forward to the next one. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks. Bye.
And bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical, as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.